Hello, everyone. Welcome to the AI podcast. My name is Athir Gathami, and my very special guest today is Lele Kao, who is Principal AI Research Scientist at Motherbrain, part of EQT Partners. Welcome, Lele.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. I think this episode will be really, really interesting, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation. But before we kickstart it, I would like to ask you, what is AI for you?
Oh, it's a very, very big concept. If I have to give a definition to AI, in general, I think AI could be a system. The system could embody a software part and hardware part. Basically, it has its internal mechanism to make intelligent decisions based on input to fulfill some use cases for human, for some kind of good purposes.
Sounds great. So Lele, I know that you have been involved with Motherbrain for a while. Of course, I know what you guys do, but could you explain to the listeners what Motherbrain does and then tell us a little bit about what you have done recently?
Sure. Motherbrain, it's a team. It has about 25 to 30 people. And Motherbrain, it's also a platform. We actually developed a web-based platform to help dual professionals to make fairer and more informed decisions using data and algorithms. And Motherbrain, it's also about a kind of analytics service that we help our stakeholders on their specific use cases. Like, for example, if they have a deal, we have a dedicated person to work with them on those deals and help them to gain insights or fulfill some kind of tasks to reach the end goal of that deal.
All right, cool. So that's like some kind of overview. So it would be really interesting to hear about what kind of cool stuff that you have done recently, like more concrete use cases.
Yeah, there were many actually I've been working on. But most recently, I would say the most interesting project that I've been working on is about Knowledge Graph. Knowledge Graph itself, it's not something new. But nowadays, with the boom of large language models, knowledge graph becomes especially important and being researched a lot more than before by researchers and industrial practitioners. The reason, I think, is largely lay on the fact that a large language model on its own, it's not able to answer the questions in your particular domain. And of course, there are approaches like RAG, retrieval augmented approaches. But at the same time, I think a lot of relations and entities that matters to some business is not captured so well in those traditional methods. So knowledge graph is becomes so important and natural for relational reasoning nowadays. Yeah.
Right. So you mentioned the retrieval augmented generation as a tool that is very popular. That's like a way of really extending the knowledge in large language model to your own data. Could you tell us what are the extra steps that need to be done in order to actually have the knowledge graph in place as opposed to just having RAG?
Oh, yeah, that's a super good question. And actually, that takes us more than a year to figure out how to do that. RAG, as the name suggests, it's mostly as simple as you have a lot of documents, mostly unstructured, and then you just brutally split them into slices. And then you encode each slice into an embedding, and then you store it in a vector space. And when you ask a question to large language models, you kind of use similarity metrics to search for relevant slices. As simple as that. And then knowledge graph, the advantage of knowledge graph is that it captures those relations in the graph. And those relations can be very easily just broken when you do this splitting of the document. So in that case, knowledge graph in itself, it manages to maintain those relations, model it in a very good way. And then concerning how to retrieve those according to your request or question, I think we have been researching around several methods. And we kind of, in the end, converge into a method that starts with sort of recognizing relevant and named entities in your question. And then we search those entities in the knowledge graph. And then we expand the according to the relations and build into the knowledge graph and retrieve a subgraph to provide it to the large language model to reason about.
Right. So from an abstract perspective, I understand this structure. In practice, how do you actually connect that to your documents? How do you go about that?
Actually, there are two levels about connecting the documents. The first level is in the document itself, right? So usually documents, they have multiple pages. And sometimes in one page, for example, it states, oh, for something, please refer to page 19, section 2, for example. In that case, we deliberately sort of bring those into the knowledge graph. And the other level is basically between the documents. Those relations could be represented by sort of hyperlinks in document A referring to document B, or sometimes simply the same person actually work on two different documents. And then those relations could be easily captured into the knowledge graph.
Right, right. And I guess you also, I mean, you have a lot of internal data like your documents, but I guess you also have some kind of external data that you connect with, right?
Yeah, exactly. You're definitely right about that. Actually, that's somewhere we started about 2 years ago. We actually, well, we knew at that time to build relations explicitly from the documents itself, because the documents, they are very much unstructured at that time. So we decided to start from third-party, mostly structured data sources in the investment domain, especially private equity. Some data sources include, for example, PitchBook, Crunchbase, and sometimes including even sort of LinkedIn as a data source. And there are many. At that time, we had about, I think we were having about more than 20 different data sources at that time. So from those data sources, we managed to extract different relations fairly easily. For example, two companies, we build a relation between them if they have sort of attended the same conference for 5 times, and then we draw a line between them and put a number on the edge saying 5, indicating they attended some kind of conference 5 times. Of course, that number becomes bigger. If the number is bigger, then their relation becomes, you know, tighter. And this is just an example. The other example include, for example, some kind of key person has worked in company A and also later in company B, responsible for a very, like working for within a very much key role. In that case, it also indicates some kind of similarity between the two companies, right? So that was where we started. And of course, as you mentioned, after we finished that part of the work and then we build also a knowledge graph from the documents, we, of course, want to enrich the two graphs that we build using each other and then create a much rich and bigger knowledge graph in the end. And that proves to be very useful nowadays.
Cool. You mentioned that it took you about a year to figure out how you should deal with knowledge graphs in your project. What was the nut that you had to crack?
If you ask me, probably two problems stand out that turns out to be quite challenging to solve well. And arguably, we are still trying to solve it in a better way. One is about what to extract, basically. Because you cannot just tell some kind of smart algorithm, say, hey, just turn this document into a knowledge graph, no matter what, right? You need to tell it what kind of relations I care about and what entities I care about, meaning that imagine in the end, you are building a knowledge graph and in the graph, it contains entities and relations. So in that sense, you need to tell the extraction mechanism, what do I care about as entities and relations? And we call it a metagraph. So in a metagraph, you're basically defining, oh, it's actually EQT employee as a kind of entity that I care about. And then there is a relation, for example, from EQT employee to another entity, which is deal. And this relation symbolizes this EQT employee actually worked in a deal, and then I draw a line between them. So this is a kind of triplet that I have to define, a metagraph, to tell the extraction mechanism. This is the kind of relation and two entities that I care about. And the other problem that we struggled in from the very beginning is what model to use to do this extraction. One thing that was pretty obvious in the beginning is we probably need to use large language models. And as you can see for the past year, the large language models have had an like tremendous evolvement from the very beginning, you know, ChatGPT until nowadays. You have many options, right? So we tested a lot of different versions. And honestly, during this process, we even invented a way to evaluate those large language models ourselves without using annotations. Because, yeah, we always had the problem, how much can we trust those benchmarking leaderboards, right? If you look at those, how those leaderboards generated, there are usually a lot of predefined question-answer pairs. And then you sort of rank those large language models based on how well they answer those questions, according to the annotations. But in our case, those questions, most of those questions are too general. It doesn't really reflect what we care about in private equity or investment. So we have to ditch that, and we have to invent an evaluation mechanism of our own that matters. And this is one thing that we actually struggled quite a bit to converge into something in the end. I think about half a year ago, we kind of converged into using ChatGPT 4V. And the reason of using 4V, well, by the way, 4V meaning that this model has a multimodal capability, being able to recognize images. You can actually provide not only text or information, but also image, several image. And this is important because we also realized, after a lot of testing, we realized only feeding the large language model with texts, it works, but sometimes it's just like really struggles. For example, there are many pages that contains images, charts, and also company logos. It's just impossible to transform them in a very easy way to pure text. And you have to take a screenshot and provide it together with the text to ChatGPT 4V to make it recognize, for example, those company logos. So that became a very important lesson learned. And nowadays, I cannot really say ChatGPT 4V is the best option because there are, well, arguably better models like Claude 3, Gemini 1.5 Pro, and most recently GPT-4o. According to our test, GPT-4o actually surpassed GPT-4v on textual intensive inputs.
Well, I hope so, since it's the same company that have made the improvement. Okay, so that's super cool. I mean, you mentioned that you basically want to have some kind of reasoning capability based on your data somehow.
Yes, right? Exactly.
So do you believe that knowledge graphs, in addition to large language models, will be enough to build general reasoning AI systems?
If you ask me, this is not enough. I would argue kind of, how to call it, a hybrid system instead. Because let me give you one very simple example. If you just ask, for example, how many people in EQT have been working with company A, for example, in the past 5 years, it takes tremendous effort to get the right answer if you just use knowledge graph, because it concerns, you know, retrieve different entities, relations. And of course, the question also lays on, have you ever extracted all the relevant relations and entities for the past 5 years? Rather, if you compare to if you just issue an, you know, query into your, you know, data warehouse, this is fairly easy. So I think knowledge graph is important, but in the end of the day, I think it's very important to have some kind of intelligent agent being able to determine what is the best information source, and then go for that source only, or a combination of different sources, and then reason about the information from different sources. Honestly, I think, because recently I've been sort of talking to the engineers from Senna AI, and I know that in their implementation of a Senna AI system, I think they are holding a very much similar belief underneath their architecture. And I'm happy to see that is actually happening in the industry.
So what do you think? I mean, this is going to be a hard question to answer. What is really the missing piece? If you would really, you know, put your finger on what's missing to build this intelligent agent, what do we need?
That's certainly a hard question, but I honestly thought about it just a bit. If you use the analogy to how a person works, I think if you ask me, for example, Lele, do you think your language capability is better than ChatGPT, right? I would say probably not because, well, one end, because I simply don't have that big vocabulary as it has. And I have not seen so many sort of writings that's ingested and learned, extracted into those models. But I'm pretty sure that's answering some questions, I can totally beat ChatGPT in its raw form. And the deciding factor is whether you have truly relevant and crispy information in your mind to answer that question. So in the end of the day, I think to be able to have some kind of truly intelligent and relevant agent or like smart stuff that can help you to answer any question, I think relevancy of context is the key to success. There were also researchers around, because this is not a new idea. People usually say, okay, in that case, I can use the large language model that has very large buffer size. I can put a lot of information in there and I don't care a lot about whether it's truly relevant. But as a matter of fact, in the end of the day, you're going to find large language model is very much like human. We cannot process that information equally efficiently or equally well in a whole buffer. Research has shown that usually the information put on the beginning of the buffer and the end of the buffer usually got a lot more attention compared to the information put like in between. So in that sense, that basically tells us probably should think about using a relatively smaller buffer size and think about the way to retrieve truly relevant information and hopefully make them crispy into your buffer. And in that case, I think things should work much better. And this is the same trend if you compare it to nowadays a lot of people is talking about, can we actually reduce the size of those models, right? To save energy, to lower the barrier, entry barrier of deploying those models. I think this is definitely a trend. And it's just very hard to believe that using so much energy to train such a model to retrieve a comparable performance to human is feasible at all. If you think about how much energy human consumes to answer those questions, it's definitely much, much lower than the current status.
Oh, definitely. So I'm still interested to dig further into the intelligent agent stuff, because it still seems to me like, all right, just having a more optimized buffer is one thing. It sounds too simple. So do you think we have the tools on the table or we need to invent something new? I would say that's probably the general question. That's everyone those who don't believe that we are near AGI, like Yann LeCun, will say that, oh, we need something new, we need to build the stuff differently. You have then the, you know, Jeff Hinton, because he got convinced by Ilya Sutskever, one of the co-founders of OpenAI, that just throw data at it. The more data, the more intelligent it will be. So I would like to hear your thoughts around that.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I wonder where I can start. Because I started my sort of AI journey or study, my PhD study started from the year 2012. At that time, people are talking about model capacity, right? They believe that the bigger the capacity model the model has, the greater it can sort of possess as a learning power. But really, what is model capacity? It usually sort of, people usually draw an equivalent sign between model capacity and its number of free parameters to be tuned nowadays. I think it's fair. And to your question, for example, in the very beginning, it seems, you know, focusing on, for example, the relevancy of the information in the buffer is simple. And after many years of research, like reading papers, I realize usually the stuff that really works in the end of the day is really the simple stuff. And you didn't realize, well, in the beginning, you think, oh, that is too simple. But in the end, actually, those simple ideas, and that works really well. And so far that I can tell is, for example, the scaling law, it just works so well so far. And there is another fun fact. In my early sort of study career, I was a medical student for a year and a half to begin with. That was 2001, 2002. That was a very interesting experience because at that time, I studied a lot of course around how, for example, human neurons, that they work together. There was a very fun fact that I learned in my early days. Actually, those neurons, they connect each other. Of course, the connection passes information through, right? But that information passing was actually more simpler than you think. There is a threshold. If you pass that threshold, the full information is going to pass through. If it doesn't pass that threshold, nothing going to pass through. if you compare it to the activation function that we are talking about today, this is like very much similar. So from neural network architecture perspective, I think if you compare with the sort of the biology sort of neurons, I think there is a reason why it should work. So from the fundamental architecture of the current, for example, transformers, neural networks, I think it's probably the right way. I think in the future, the biggest advancement perhaps well lies on, for example, recently people are talking about Khan network, right? There is a new way to structure a neural network. But anyway, this is still a neural network. And I think I would expect it to see a tremendous advancement of how to do computation more efficiently so that the size, the free parameters, could be significantly reduced in the future, but still with the same capacity. I think, I'm not sure right now how to sort of get there, but I think it will happen sooner or later.
Oh, I appreciate the last comment because it's actually one of the topics that I personally work on. And I think it's very, very central.
Oh, cool.
The development of AI. You mentioned now like how, or you compared with the human brain, you know, how we process information and the usage of energy by the human brain. And do you believe that we might need other type of software to match this small amount of energy consumption that humans need in order to process information and think and take decisions? Or do you think that actually even with the computer hardware that we have today, we could probably do something that is equally efficient?
I mostly believe in hardware advancement could bring the majority of the uplifting of computation efficiency. Because the improvement of software on the same set of hardware, I think there is a ceiling that we can all see. And it's just feels a bit, suspicious about, you know, surpassing that ceiling with using the same hardware. I think in the future, probably, well, I think NVIDIA, like the reason nowadays why NVIDIA is so successful is actually an example of that, right? NVIDIA was recognized before the boom of deep learning. NVIDIA was recognized as one of the, you know, the video card, like if you play a video game, if you want a good performance and everything, that is the kind of hardware you should go to. Until one day that people find out, oh, actually, you can use NVIDIA's video card to do more efficient matrix operations. In that sense, you know, switching from CPU to GPU, suddenly giving a large boost of deep learning and its applications. But actually, did NVIDIA's video cards actually specifically defined or designed for the kind of, you know, the activation functions and back propagations and et cetera, you know, those fundamental things that is underneath that makes the whole thing work? I would say it's not yet. There are plenty of space that could be improved there. And not even mentioning the, you know, the quantum computing that could basically change the whole thing in the future. There are already sort of preliminary researchers around how you can actually calculate a very simple thing that takes about, you know, years in current days, sort of video cards, GPUs, comparing to if you're using quantum computing, it takes just, you know, seconds or minutes. The difference is huge. Although I guess there are still many years to go, but I don't have problem to believe it will come.
That's super interesting. And I agree that I think there's a lot of room for hardware manufacturers to really design more focused hardware for AI applications that probably run much more efficiently. I mean, we have like two things to think about, right? There's the training part. I think that's where NVIDIA has put a lot of focus. But also there's the inference part, I think, where not much is happening. Right now, I know maybe one startup, Silicon Valley, and that's it. So yeah, these are definitely really interesting areas. I mean, just recently, I mean, you mentioned OpenAI ChatGPT 4.0 stands for Omni. Did you have the chance to try it?
Yeah, I did. I actually kicked off our evaluation on this model right after it's published, it's released. It's very exciting to see its end-to-end voice function. It's just like mimics so well how humans interact with each other, communicate with each other. But in our evaluation, we are more sort of focused on its model capability. Basically, if I give you, for example, an image, can you precisely describe what's in there? and not trying to hallucinate. According to our test, I think, yeah, as I mentioned earlier, GPT-4o did so well in textual intensive images, meaning that in your input images, there are some kind of textual information, but still represented in a very much a graphical manner, like logo, company logo, for example. But overall, according to our test results, Google's Gemini 1.5 still sort of slightly better than the average performance of a GPT-4o, especially on visual intensive images. Gemini 1.5 is still slightly better.
Did you, like, besides evaluation, did you like try any some new functionality? I just thought, okay, this is cool, this is new.
Well, this is definitely on our schedule. From its multimodal capability, I think we still don't have a strong enough reason to already switch what we have in our implementation. But from its end-to-end voicing function, I think this is super cool. Maybe in the future, we're going to see a mother brain platform that you can talk to, right? That's going to be super cool idea.
Actually, I do believe personally that this is where we're going to see one of the biggest advances in integrating ChatGPT and other apps. That's for sure.
I agree.
So, Lela, any other recent developments that you have observed in the research world that caught your interest?
Recently, there was this paper actually recommended also by Ilya, right? It's called the Platonic Representation Hypothesis. This is a great idea. It basically, well, this is an interesting paper. I personally haven't sort of read it super carefully, but after I skimmed through it, I find the idea is very intriguing because it basically claims that all AI models that you train on all modalities, they actually converge into some kind of shared space, shared embedding space or representation space. And if you compare to what we try to do with our evaluation strategy to on different multimodal large language models, this is a very good support of our idea because in our case, the way that we do our evaluation is basically letting the multimodal large language model to look at the picture and then describe it and use the description only to redraw the picture and so on and so on and so on. This idea basically builds on the assumption of this Platonic representation hypothesis. If they sort of align so well in the same space, then this method actually makes sense. If they don't, then this method could be a bit shaky. I think this is a really cool idea, and I hope hopefully I'll see more sort of experiments out of it.
We will see. Actually, it's I would say it's like interesting theoretical concept. I don't know how it will progress the AI development in practice. It's definitely interesting. And I'm still like, there's so many interesting things happening, but there are still stuff that I think we're not really understanding. Just to teach an AI to perform an algorithm is not clear how to
certainly
do it. So, which is funny because an algorithm, but it still cannot how to follow like a set of rules to execute something. I mean, it could be something simple as adding to like large numbers where it's not really part of its memory, basically. So interesting. So Lela, we have come close to the end of our episode, and I would like to ask you for a recommendation of a series, movie, documentary, or a book with AI as a topic.
On top of my mind, if you're talking about movie, then this, well, kind of old movie called Her actually surfaced up recently because of the development of large language models. Honestly, the first time when I watched that movie, I didn't thought it would be like a very eye-catching movie, so cool. But nowadays, if I think about that movie again, I think that was simply awesome. Like it basically predicted what's happening now, right? So I definitely would suggest to watch that again. And myself would like to watch it again. And there are actually two books that I personally read in my early sort of research career that I can certainly recommend. One book is called The Beauty of Mathematics in Computer Science. It's authored by Dr. Wu Jin. I simply loved it. You simply don't have to possess any strong mathematical knowledge to understand it, which includes a lot of the successful applications today. And the other book that I can recommend is called Algorithm to Live By, The Computer Science in Human Decisions. I think it's authored by Bran and Tom, if I remember correctly. But this also talks about how can you compare your like how you live your life to solve a lot of real life, real world questions using a mindset of optimization. I think this is simply cool.
Oh, I love it. Actually, I'm not aware of this book, but you made me interested in reading that book.
Yeah.
Sounds great. By the way, the movie Her, I think I had the opposite feeling when I really saw it first time. I thought it was so good because I really thought this would probably be, I mean, I've seen a lot of science fiction movies, but I thought this is really close. I mean, if we would really experience AI, something like that felt like not really far, far away. It would happen. It wasn't like impossible. It wasn't like just theoretical stuff. It felt like, yeah, we could see that. I mean, I didn't know if it's like in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, not where. But now, who knows now with the ChatGPT, Omni, and probably we'll see other chatbots. Will probably be such an AI companion.
Yeah, I totally agree. Agree with you on that point, yes.
So, Lele, it has been great pleasure to have you with us in this episode. Thanks again for being our guest. I really enjoyed our conversation. I hope that we talk soon.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.